In the half-light of a full moon's glow on a clear and crisp January night, a shivering man is casting stalks of yarrow upon the frozen ground. He is shivering not only because he is cold, but also because the results of his actions will have such profound effects on him, and he is rightly concerned. The man is Hieronymus Bosworth, a 20th century experimentalist and the slowest composer in the world. Each note of each composition is guided by the I Ching, an ancient form of divination and the fundamental oracle of Confucianism. Reading the I Ching involves casting yarrow stalks to build a series of six lines called a hexagram. Each line is either yin, the passive feminine force, or yang, the active masculine force. Pithy passages in the I Ching then reveal the meaning of each line. There are 64 possible hexagrams, each of which can be broken down into three-line groups called trigrams, which in turn can be further divided into rudimentary brainwave activity or electroencephalograms. Bosworth is working on a composition now, a piece for either solo voice or buzuki.
Or solo voice and bouzouki.
How did you do that?
Well, I composed a piece for solo voice and bouzouki.
Amazing.
For today's show.
Picking the instrument. That's it. That's the piece. Picking the instrument is itself a prolonged interaction with the I Ching. He has been writing the piece for 11 years and is just now approaching the 40 measure mark. The total number of notes is...
Yeah, at which this is 40 measures.
No, is it...
40 long measures.
The total number of notes
in
is...
In each part.
Is 902. Oh, yeah. You do the math. It's already been done, apparently. Oh, my. He begins the process by first silently asking the oracle, "What note shall next be?" Then he throws the yarrow stalks. Each stalk is uniquely scented, and the way their combined odors register on Bosworth's smellomometer determines the equivalent number. The first throw yields a 7, as do the second and third, making for a bottom trigram of Jian, the creative. Bosworth smiles. He may get several notes tonight, which would be an all-time record for him. But he probably won't. Every throw involves new yarrow stalks. This is neither demanded nor endorsed by the I Ching or its assigns. It's strictly a Bosworth thing. Ergo, a lot of perfectly good composing time is instead spent harvesting and prepping an Eurasian weed. It's not a romantic notion that has him outside on this cold, moonlit night clutching a handful of yarrow. But it's Friday, penny ante night, and his small flat is otherwise engaged by Schnitzler, his schnauzer, sitting at the dining room table with three other yappy dogs noisily playing poker. The next throw is an 8, yin. Line 5, 8. Line 6, 8, a yin line. Bosworth sniffs the yarrow. It smells a little like chicken. Hexagram 26, Ta Chu, the taming power of the great.
The great chicken.
He withdraws the ancient book from a hidden pocket in his dashiki, turns to the appropriate page, and reads.
It furthers one to embark on the journey. The enlightening experience is to partake of the great walnut.
Sounds like an E flat, though it could be an F double flat if the yin line is deemed gray or changing. He continues.
10 pairs of old women's shoes cannot reach him. Constant perseverance brings many nuisances. The walnut awaits the blessing of the efficacious tortoise.
There's that walnut again. Maybe it isn't an E-flat after all, for don't nuts and C's typically dwell exclusively in C major? He reads the concluding three lines.
The walls fall back into the moat. One is enriched through unfortunate events. That isn't chicken you're smelling, Buster.
Bosworth checks his smellomometer. Sure enough, the chicken odor was left over from an earlier reading. He diligently cleans the gauge, points it at the six lines of yarrow again, and jots down the new measurements. 6, 1, 1, 4, 9, 5. Good grief! With the unfavorable line 9 in the fifth place, it's hexagram 28. Bosworth sniffs the yarrow and grimaces. Definitely traces of copper sulfate. That's Takuo, all right. He shivers in trepidation because he's visited 28 often. In fact, the book readily falls open to that page, which is wrinkled from overuse.
Perseverance brings humiliation. It must be announced truthfully at the court of the dog.
As has accompanied so many previous readings, somewhere in the distance, a dog barks. Bosworth sighs and continues.
No blame if you are sincere and walk in the middle, but the danger sitting in the boat also lurks unseen beneath the water's surface. The walnut's wisdom remains elusive. One must therefore resort to contemplating the omnipotent zipper. Have a nice day.
Bosworth doesn't bother to turn the page to the commentary because he already knows what it will advise him to do. Use his intuition. Given the nature of his compositional style, however, that's simply not likely. A sudden gust of wind scatters the yarrow stalks, obliterating the lines of the hexagram. Again, in the distance, a dog barks. Momentarily thinking like a composer, Bosworth imagines that it sounds a little like an E-flat. A little like an E-flat. Yeah, there. Then let it be so, he decides, abruptly rousing from his glum reverie. He roots around in his dashiki's other pocket, but discovers that he has exhausted his supply of yarrow. Well, he'll just have to figure out which E-flat another time, he reasons, as he heads for home, for once not averse to a round or two of poker. Today's 448th round of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar is brought to you by Hexagram 63.
3333.
The reinterpretation of history, which concludes with the lines.
I can't read these.
Oh, right. Seize the moment. Cesium oxide. Si calvus.
C'est si bon.
Si tre.
Ah.
Wow, a tune just for that. Well,
just
I'm...
for that. Boozavox.
Oh,
or voice and bazooki.
I thought you said you were being a slow composer. That just kind of...
I was just avoiding what I was supposed to be doing, of course. What else do you think?
Oh, yeah.
And now we're currently listening to something a little bit more rewarding. The concluding section of Morton Feldman's Three Voices, composed for Joan LaBarbera, whose three voices you hear, a 1982 piece, and whose voice you will hear throughout today's show because she is our guest.
Woohoo!
Let's listen to the end of... Morton Feldman's Three Voices. The concluding section of Three Voices by Morton Feldman, that's called Slow Waltz and Ending.
Just gorgeous.
Joan LaBarbera, the voice, of course, the phenomenal Joan LaBarbera. We were a bit in awe.
We were.
Yeah. We were in awe shucks mode for a considerable beginning part of the interview anyway. So it's a long interview and long pieces of music to go with it. So let's head right to New York City. This recorded in June of 2003.
Right, August was the other coast.
It was the other coast, right. So here we are heading to New York City with our interview with Joan LaBarbera at the American Music Center.
It's not often we get a person with two first names to talk to.
That's right, and a double middle initial.
The?
La.
Oh, La.
La.
Yes. I was translating it into the English.
Ah, the.
La.
Joan LaBarbera.
Right.
Joan LaBarbera, welcome to Calvus and Damien on
the
road.
Road.
Well, thank you for having me here.
This is really great. We have been influenced by your work for years. And sometimes it's just serendipity. I picked your LPs out of a bin once, and you know, one of those enthusiastic record buyers bought them, and then they sort of sat there. And I was astounded. I think it was some of the first really unusual voice work I had heard that was contoured rather than expressive of somebody else's ideas. And it was just amazing. Take us through your sort of summary of your history as both a performer and a composer.
Ah, well, let's see. That could take quite some time.
We have time.
Okay. I was trained as a classical singer in the bel canto tradition. And at a certain point in my education, I started to get curious about what the voice could do in addition to what I had been taught. And I started looking around and listening to things, and I saw and heard instrumentalists who were experimenting with their instruments, but really no vocalists who were doing it, with the exception of if you looked at jazz. And obviously there were a lot of singers in jazz, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, many, many people who had really been using the voice as an instrument, but nobody in the sort of area that I was interested. So I started to just work with other instrumentalists, having them play long tones, and I would try to imitate the sounds of instruments, and gradually began improvising. And I was in New York. This was early 70s, and actually another radio station, WBAI, had a place called the Free Music Store, and it was operating in some empty church. And on Thursday nights, people could just show up and get together and make music. And so I went there and I met people like Steve Lacy and Anthony Braxton and Frederick Jevsky, and started to work on, you know, improvising and stretching my ideas. Learned a great deal at that point. Also, I had started doing commercial work because I was in New York, had to make a living.
Commercial work meaning literally...
Meaning radio commercials.
Literally
work, singing for radio commercials. This will sort of date when it was. I guess my first one was for a Japanese perfume.
I love which extends to this day of working in that medium.
What?
During Japanese commercials for Japanese manufactured products.
Do I still do that?
Yes.
No.
Oh, no.
No.
Would we know here in the States any of your commercials? This is a terrible question, I suppose.
Well, it depends. Actually, the ones that I was doing at that time were for a composer, Michael Saul. I don't know if you know him.
Oh, yes. Michael's been a guest on our show.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so he was also Judy Collins' pianist at that time. And so this Japanese commercial that I had been hired to do, they had a Japanese singer, but the advertising executives decided she was too Japanese sounding for American audiences. And so they brought me in to imitate, you know, what they thought it should sound like. And they started out with my imitating the sound of a koto, which of course was not a koto, because they thought a koto was too exotic sounding. So they were using a harp imitating a koto. So I was imitating a harp, imitating a koto. And we ran the gamut of all of these different ideas because they really didn't have any idea what they wanted. And finally, I wound up sounding sort of like a Japanese Astro Gilberto. Anyway, that was a long, long time ago. I did commercials for Eastern Airlines.
Wow.
I mean, that tells you how long ago it was. Mm-hmm. That's been out of business for many, many years. North American Van Lines. God, I don't know. All these
different things.
Anyway, because of the commercials, Michael knew that I could do all of these different things with my voice, and he recommended me to Steve Reich, who was looking for a singer who could imitate the sounds of an instrument.
Right, right.
And so I went and I sang for Steve, and this was during the time that he was developing his work drumming. And originally he thought that the voice should imitate the sound of bongo drums.
Mm-hmm.
And then he decided that a male voice was better imitating the sound of bongo drums. So he did that. And I was hired on to imitate the sound of marimbas. And that was the development of drumming. Roughly...
How long did you work with him?
I worked with Steve from about 1970 to about 74.
Okay.
During that time, there were three different works, I believe. It was drumming and music for mallet instruments, voices, and organ. Maybe it was just those two. So I did all the performances from 71 to 74 of those works, and also the Deutsche Grammophon recordings of those. And also was working with an improvisation ensemble that I put together with a number of other musicians and composers or composing performers or performer composers, whatever you call us.
It was that kind of active time when everyone was doing
a little bit
of everything. Yeah.
I also started working with Philip Glass in 73. And at the time, he actually showed up at a concert that Steve was doing at an art gallery down in Soho. And I introduced myself, and he said, "Do you know my music?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, we're doing a concert over in the Bowery, you know, next week. Why don't you come and listen to it?" So I said, "Have you ever thought of using a voice?" And he said, "No, not really." He said, "I mean, it's so funny at this point in time when all we think about Philip Glass is
operas
and all of this stuff."
Wonderful, yeah.
But at that time, he said, "No, you know, Yvonne Rainer, the filmmaker, comes by every once in a while and screams and yells. But other than that, you know, I hadn't really thought about voice." So I went to the concert, and it was at this grungy loft, like 10 flights up and someplace on the Bowery. I had to climb up past these screeching guard dogs and everything. And I got up there, and the ensemble was sitting around in a circle, and there were, I don't know, I guess about 5 or 6 guys and maybe 10 or 15 people sitting around them. That was the audience. And I listened to it. I really enjoyed it. And we talked afterwards, and I said, "Yeah, I like it." He said, "Okay, well, our trumpet player just left the group. How about if you come in and sing the trumpet part?" So I said, "Sure, why not?" So I came in and sang music that was already written for trumpet. And then he was beginning work on his music in 12 parts at that point. So we did a lot of talking about what the voice could do, how long you could stay in any particular area without fatiguing mm-hmm. the instrument. And as you know, music in 12 parts is a very, very long piece. So I just basically explained to him, you know, physical things about the voice, what it could do, what it couldn't do. And I was very interested still in using my voice to imitate or blend with the instrument. So if he had orchestrated a piece, let's say, for the Farfisa organ, which is what he played at the time, and saxophones, I would blend more with the saxophone. Whereas if one of the pieces was more for flutes, then I would alter the timbre and sing more. So you still recognized it as a voice, but it was just blending the timbre so that it matched more, and the voice was part of the texture instead of being a solo instrument. And working with Steve, working with Phil, doing this improvisation work, I realized I had a lot of ideas that composers were not necessarily going to write for because they didn't know what could be done. So I began to compose. And my first works were more or less etudes. They were studies on particular things that I was working on. For instance, the voice piece, One Note Internal Resonance Investigation, which was exploring all of the timbral and coloristic possibilities that one could make or produce using a single pitch, but just altering it with resonances and various things, and harmonics, overtone isolation, getting into something that later became called multiphonics, right, which is the double stop for the voice, a kind of very unusual sound for the voice to make. And when I first started making that sound and doing it in concert, people said, oh, that sounds like the Tibetan monks. But it really is a very different technique, because I don't actually sing those very, very low tones, which is what the monks do. Mm-hmm. I'm creating a false secondary subtone,
right,
which in a strange way follows the harmonic series, only turned upside down. Mm-hmm. So instead of an octave above, you first get an octave below. If I can really relax my vocal cords, I can get an octave and a fifth, so a triple stop.
Now, on this, there's a CD re-release of your early work. Can we hear some of that?
Yes,
on that?
Yes.
All right, let's take a quick cut over to this. This is a re-release. It's called Voice is the Original Instrument. It's a wonderful two-disc set on lovely music. And what piece shall we listen to for this?
Voice piece, One Note Internal Resonance Investigation.
That's the very first cut. Let's hear it. This is by Joan LaBarbera.
But first,
a
little bit of early business.
Hello, I'm Kyoko Kobayashi, and you're listening to Carlos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR, Plainfield.
Yes. Flag.
Ships. Non-Pop International
mm-hmm.
Network. Let's get right to this from Voices, the Original Instrument, because we got lots of music to squish in today. This is about 15 minutes long. One Note, Internal Resonances, music by Joan LaBarbera. Oh.
Oh.
voice piece, one note internal resonance investigation by Joan LaBarbera. That's from a wonderful new re-release on Lovely Music. And let's pick your career up from there. It's an amazing thing because at that time, things really started to change.
Yes.
People started to go other places, and there was a cross-influence of your work and other work.
Yes, indeed. I actually, when I was out touring with Philip Glass, if there were nights when the ensemble wasn't performing, Philip was very happy for any of the members of the ensemble to do solo concerts. And so I started doing my solo concerts. And the strange thing for people at that time was that I didn't need an accompanist, that I was singing, voice alone, a very, very strange concept at that point in time. And it became for me almost like a manifesto, the idea that the voice was a complete instrument. I mean, everybody knows you can do violin recitals, you can do cello recitals, piano recitals, but who had heard of a voice recital without someone else? So that was very revolutionary. I also started working with electronics, and I picked up some stuff that had been developed basically for electric guitar players. But by feeding the voice into them, I could do just as many things with that, and started to then think of the electronics as I would think of other instrumentalists.
And what kind of things could you do with that?
Well, I picked up something called a space echo, which was a device that allowed me. It was like a tape looping device, but you could change the speed. Or the length of repetitions, very early, very rudimentary at that point. This was like 75, I think. Also a phase shifter, which sort of put a kind of sine wave white noise and would alter your voice that way.
It got very popular with DJs in the radio stations at the time. They used to take two identical recordings and phase shift them out.
Yeah.
It was a very way of making a pop recording sound really edgy.
I also use something called a frequency analyzer, which is like a ring modulator, adding tones above and below. And so by mixing and matching and adding all this stuff together, I could improvise with it. And I like the idea of surprising myself. So I'd be using all of my own extended vocal techniques and then punch in one of these devices and be surprised and then work with that as if it were another musician who was, surprising me with a new sound. And on that same CD, the work Vocal Extensions uses that set of live electronic devices.
I think we can hear probably part of this. Do you think we can get away with just hearing part of this?
Absolutely.
Let's listen to an excerpt from Vocal Extensions. This is from Voice is the Original Instrument on Lovely Music. Our guest today on Calvos and Damien is Joan LaBarbera.
Thank you.
Vocal extensions, Joan LaBarbera.
By this time, were you encountering other musicians, other vocalists who were interested in what you were doing and wanted to follow what you were doing?
Yeah, there were, well, of course, there was Kathy Berberian, who had worked with her at that time husband, Luciano Berio. And I was fascinated with the recordings that I had heard of Kathy. She began to include what we would consider non-musical sounds, coughing, laughing, gasping, a little bit of inhaled singing. And so she worked with Berio and also with John Cage. There was a wonderful, huge collection of works that Cage wrote for her called the Songbooks, many of which she performed, many of which she never performed. And later on, when I met Cage, I got to do first performances of some of those works. And actually in 1974, Kathy had been doing workshops in Europe, and she decided she just had so much work, she wanted to turn it over to another person. And so she turned over some of her workshops to me to carry on. So there was a nice kind of sort of handing over of the mantle. There were also, of course, other singers, Meredith Monk, for example, a composer doing her own very different and unique style of using the voice in theatrical pieces. Let's see, a little bit later on, there was a group called the Extended Vocal Techniques Ensemble that was developed in California at the University of San Diego, or UC San Diego.
Were that the harmonic singer?
No, these were, it was four singers, Debbie Cavash, Linda Vickerman, Philip Larson, and Ed Harkins. And they were part of a group called the Extended Vocal Techniques Ensemble, quartet. And they did works of Roger Reynolds. They also were experimenting a lot, and they were working with doctors at a local hospital who were photographing their vocal cords as they made some of these unusual sounds to see, you know, how in the world they were doing them, if there was anything unusual about their vocal cords. They also developed something called the lexicon for extended vocal techniques, where they would demonstrate a sound and then wrote out a description of how the sound was produced. Somewhat later, there were other singers, Diamanda Galas, sure, for example. Yeah. But I would say she came along maybe in the late 70s, possibly.
The first recording that we have of hers is late 70s, 78, I believe, Panopticon was released.
Yeah,
and that was,
She was doing some more traditional work. She studied at UC San Diego with Carol Plantamura and probably came in contact with that group that I just mentioned. And she was also working with Vinko Globokar, I think, on some pieces, and then began doing her own work also. So I think, you know, with a lot of us, we started in one realm and sort of that led us to doing compositions at that point. I had mentioned John Cage, and maybe you're interested in.
Well, let's take a side trip down a question lane that was brought up first just a few weeks ago on our show by Hanna Bosma. Hanna Bosma is a composer and a musicologist in the Netherlands who has been working on the concept of authorship and was very concerned that authorship has been almost exploited by composers, but in using so they can use their name on a composition when, in fact, not only the sort of lexicon of materials, the library of materials, the concepts, were intimately involved with the performers they were working with, and in fact, the majority of the material was developed from ideas that the performers had themselves made possible. And so the composers were kind of just assemblers at that point, really sort of composers of the material rather than originators. And the real creative authorship belongs with the performers. And her sort of division point was Kathy Berberian and forward. Do you have a sort of a strong feeling about the authorship being needed to be shifted? Was that the reason that you went into composing, and some of your others did associates did the same thing?
It's actually a fascinating point, and probably was a great part of the impetus for my getting into composing. Of course. You know, when I was very young, I was very interested in working with other people, and I benefited greatly by the sharing of ideas. I did not have formal composition training, and so I felt as if I was getting a great deal from the composers that I worked with, just in ways of organizing the thoughts, organizing the ideas. I had a lot of ideas, but how to actually put them together was something that I hadn't studied. So I felt a little bit intimidated. The more that I worked with composers, the stronger I began to feel about my own ideas, their validity, their value, and that I actually was a composer. I didn't actually feel what I hear in you describing Hannah's dissertations as a kind of anger or as if I was being ripped off. I felt as if it was a kind of contribution that many, many instrumentalists and singers have contributed to composers over the years. I know there are a lot of questions. For example, if you take the late works of John Cage, the number pieces, where you have blocks of time and the performers are simply asked to choose 1 to 10 or 1 to 12 sounds, and you insert them in those blocks of time. What the composer has done is to set up the form, and what the interpreter does is to provide the content of the form. But that's an agreement. It's an agreement between the performer and the composer. And you can choose not to participate in that kind of music if you feel as if you're going to be ripped off. I feel as if when I'm realizing a work by John Cage, I'm trying to investigate the form, and I'm trying to investigate my ideas and how they can contribute to that form. When I then go out and do my own composition, I'm free to use, I could use very similar material, but the way I order it is what makes me the composer. So I think there's sort of a fine line there of distinction about who is the composer and when. And if you're going to get angry about a composer ripping you off, then you probably should just compose and not work for another composer. In the case of Kathy, I think it is rather clear that she had a number of unique things that she did with her instrument and unique ideas that she was developing that Luciano greatly took advantage of. Cage, to a lesser degree, because I think actually the music that he wrote for Kathy was fairly well written out and spelled out. So I think actually Luciano took more advantage of her. And the only work that I know that Kathy composed was her work Stripsody. Right. Which was a kind of comic strip realization. I think she could have done much more, but she probably didn't feel strong enough at that point in time.
She was pioneering in a lot of ways.
She was pioneering in a great many ways, and unfortunately, toward the end of her life, she became very bitter, and I think did feel used, and was she felt as if she had been treated like a sort of freak, And she was constantly trying to remind people that she could sing classical music. You know, her great Monteverdi to the Beatles concert that she did all over the world was this see what I can do kind mm-hmm. of thing. She did a very strange thing. During the intermission of a concert I was doing at the Holland Festival in 76, I was invited to do a radio interview, and I was too involved with, you know, putting stuff together. It was the intermission of the concert. I said, no, I can't do it now. I'll do it later. So Kathy did the interview and got on and said dreadful things about people who did extended vocal techniques. And it was such a shock when I heard somebody provided me with a cassette of the interview later on, and I listened to it. I was totally dumbfounded, because here was this person that I felt was a pioneer who was just absolutely trashing those of us who were out there doing what we thought was carrying on her tradition. So I actually took the interview and put it into a piece called Cathing. That's mm-hmm. that's available also, where I cut up her words. And I played a one-minute segment from the interview, which is the most inflammatory part. And then I cut it up. This would be called sampling techniques now, but at the time, right, sure. physically, we were cutting pieces of tape. And then modified it electronically, and then put it into a multi-layered composition using my extended vocal techniques. So we have her trashing extended vocal techniques and altered electronically, and we have my voice sort of doing the extended vocal techniques. So that was a great, fun piece.
Well, let's hear that now, and we'll come back, and we'll okay. pick up with you again.
Okay.
Here it is, Cathing from Voices of the Original Instrument, Joan LaBarbera.